Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, September 5th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some local headlines. Our first local news story today has a headline that reads, Labor Day finds North Iowa employers optimistic. Labor Day, the early September tribute to workers, has been an official holiday for almost 130 years. As they did in the late 1800s, workers are facing rapid economic transformation. Between writers and actors on strike, contentious contract negotiations that led up to a new labor deal for 340,000 unionized UPS workers, and active picket lines across multiple industries, the labor in Labor Day is again at the forefront of the holiday, arguably more than it has been in recent memory. Nationally and in Iowa, a strong job market continues to present a favorable picture for workers. U.S. hired picked up in August, and wage growth slowed. The labor market has been a pillar of the U.S. economy this year, providing momentum that may help the nation avert recession. While job openings and wage gains have both retreated in recent months, hiring and incomes are still firm enough to bolster consumer spending. But while fear of possible recession lingers, several North Iowa business leaders contacted by the Globe Gazette expressed optimism about the local economy and what it means for the workforce. The Federal Reserve has been increasing its short-term rate in an effort to curb inflation, and there are indications that is working, said Paul Stevenson, president and chief credit officer at Clear Lake Bank and Trust Company, in an email. It is likely we will experience some softening in the local economy. However, I don't think North Iowa will experience a long-term recession. North Iowa benefits from having a good balance between the farming and business communities. We rarely see extreme swings in our local economy, especially to the downside. We have strong business leaders that manage and prepare their organization for changes in the economy. At Sukup Manufacturing in Sheffield, the outlook also is optimistic as the manufacturer of grain storage, grain drying and handling equipment, and steel buildings has recently added workers and a new location in Clear Lake. We've had a busy past couple of years, expanding footprint not only in Sheffield, but Manly, Hampton, and now Clear Lake, Emily Schmidt, Chief Administrative Officer and General Counsel, told the Globe Gazette. All have been positive, and our hiring has been positive in all of those areas. Having these numerous job sites allows us to meet employees closer to where they live, which also leads to being able to leverage their networks in the community for staffing up a strong workforce. As we gain further time from the pandemic, supply chain issues, fluctuations at the gas pump, we have seen an increase in our customers planning further ahead for their buying decisions, which in turn helps us make earlier decisions to strategic plan for the betterment of our customers. So we are optimistic of what we can do heading into 2024 already. North Iowa is a great location to live and thrive, and we've seen the results of investing in our region for economic growth, she said. At CLTEL, the Clear Lake-based telecommunications company and internet provider, a strong local business environment prompts rosy expectations for the future. As we keep an eye on things nationally, we are cautiously optimistic, said Chris Lovell, chief operating officer. Here in our backyard of North Iowa, we are very bullish about the many exciting economic development initiatives and amenities that have come to fruition or will soon. When it comes to staying connected in this ever-changing world, we foresee a continued high demand for reliable and fast internet service, both in the near and long term. In August, First Citizens Bank sponsored its first annual Rural Economic Development Summit in partnership with North Iowa Area Community College and the North Iowa Corridor. The event left attendees certain that North Iowa is posed for growth. We couldn't have been more pleased with the turnout, with approximately 350 attendees, said Jeffrey Gribben, president at First Citizens Bank. The interaction between the audience and the presenters during the summit and during the breaks was a clear sign that local governmental and business leaders in North Iowa have a positive outlook for the future. While the past few years have proven that no one has a crystal ball when it comes to where interest rates and markets will head, we do know from experience that when communities are investing in the future, it leads to positive outcomes. At First Citizens Bank, we see the investment in our local schools and infrastructure as a positive sign for the future, and we look forward to hosting the Rural Economic Development Summit annually to continue to help drive investment in North Central Iowa. Our next local story has a headline that reads, "Accused Eagle Grove Sex Abuser Demands Speedy Trial." An Eagle Grove man charged with multiple counts of sexual abuse has demanded a speedy trial, prompting a jury trial scheduled for October 31st. According to court records, 39-year-old Orvelio Ramirez Abarca has been charged with 2 counts of second-degree sexual abuse and 3 counts of third-degree sexual abuse. The law requires the court to begin a trial within 90 days of prosecutors filing the trial information. In this case, that happened on August 4th. The affidavits state that starting in January, Ramirez Abarca had sexual relations with a child under the age of 14 at his residence and in his van in the parking lot west of Eagle Grove High School. The investigating officer reported that originally Ramirez Abarca denied being with the child, but then said they were dating and having a sexual relationship. Ramirez Abarca was arrested on July 26th and arraigned on August 30th. This local news headline reads, "Andy Blumenthal inducted into Iowa Rock and Roll Association Hall of Fame." Master player Andy Blumenthal, age 72, of Mason City, was inducted into the Iowa Rock and Roll Music Association Hall of Fame on Sunday. Blumenthal has been traveling light and sitting in with his own and other bands for 57 years. Blumenthal plays predominantly blues and early rock and roll, though he spent a number of years in Minnesota and Iowa as a music leader and performer in both his churches and at tent revivals across the region. His current band, Kilroy, plays a mix of popular rock and roll hits from over the decades. Blumenthal is a familiar figure at live music venues around town. In his signature Greek fishing hat and suspenders, he slips through crowded bars without attracting much attention until he plays. He came by his love for music at an early age. At just 3 years old, he would fetch records for his older brother, Alan, known as Butch, by sight rather than reading the labels. His parents signed him up for piano lessons at age 9 to foster the talent he clearly had, but with mixed results. "There was a great big picture window right in the room with the piano," Blumenthal recalls. "I never got any good at the piano because I could see all my friends playing outside." He didn't play in a band or take any formal music lessons, but the music his brother and 2 older sisters, Eleanor and Roberta, played never quite left his head. At age 15, Blumenthal moved from New York to New Jersey. Kids in the area were playing guitar. The music scene was hopping, but Blumenthal couldn't bring himself to haul the equipment, so he picked up a harmonica. I'm the fastest setup and teardown guy in any band I play with, he laughed. And there have been a lot of bands. First band I ever joined was with Artie Gary back in Plainfield, New Jersey, Blumenthal said. It was called Azalea, like the flower, but we didn't know that. So we called ourselves Azulia, named after the Azalea Court Apartments. There's been A-Train and the Straight Freight Blues Band, Main Attraction, and Kilroy, if we're marking bands Blumenthal has been an official member of. He sat in and played along with so many, he can't list them all. He sat in with Larry Meyer, Skeeter Lewis, and the All-Stars, even Kevin Burt, and he's a global star now, said Matt Perez, owner of Lorado's on the Plaza. Kent and Cindy Christensen opened the Bourbon Street Bar on Clear Lake's South Shore in 1999. Wednesday nights featured an open jam. There was almost an ultimatum that bands had to let Andy sit in. He'd been around a bit by then, but really got to know area musicians from those open jam sit-ins. His talent can blow you away, said Christensen. Out of all the venues he's played, Blumenthal considers Lorado's his home. Venues don't step on each other's toes, explains Blumenthal. If you are a regular booked at one spot, you're not going to be featured other places. It's no hard and fast rule, but it's there. Matt Perez now owns Lorado's after a recent purchase, but Julie and Rex Burgo had quite a bit to do with Blumenthal's local success. When Lorado's opened in 1993, it didn't have a jukebox. The Burgos overcame the issue by regularly hosting live music, featuring local musicians. In 2017, Lorado's was inducted into the Iowa Rock and Roll Music Association Hall of Fame as well. It was Julie Burgo who nominated Blumenthal in the individual artist category. Andy has been absolutely vital to the music scene in Mason City, Julie said. For 29 years, we called Andy our house harp player. Every now and then, we'd get a band that was having an off night or just wasn't that great, and Andy would get right up and have them back on track in no time. Nominating him was an easy decision. He should be in the Hall of Fame. Rich Mock is another Hall of Fame inductee. He received his honor in 2018. Bourbon Street was fertile ground for local musicians, and it really all started with open mic, said Mock. The Hall of Fame ceremony is really great. They do an amazing job of making artists feel special for a day. It gives recognition in an industry where we don't always get it. The nomination came as a surprise to Blumenthal, who got the news at a concert on the Principal Pavilion. Rex and Julie called me over, and they had another couple with them. That's when I met Tim Coffey, who sits on the Hall of Fame board. They just told me, you're in, Blumenthal said. Blumenthal thinks being a Hall of Famer won't change things much. He's been thinking for a while now about starting up a little blues trio. It's nice to be recognized, but what matters is the camaraderie between musicians. God gave me this talent, so he should get the credit. The Iowa Rock and Roll Music Association Hall of Fame Weekend Spectacular ran from August 31st to September 3rd in Arnold's Park. Don and Dennis Higgins were inducted into the Hall of Fame on Sunday in the support person category. And now turning to some statewide headlines. This one reads, Iowa governor denies influence over summit pipeline process. Governor Kim Reynolds has not influenced the state permit process for a proposed carbon dioxide pipeline that is nearing its conclusion, a spokesperson said this week. The comment was in response to a landowner's recent assertion that Reynolds and other elected leaders have favored Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline project over their constituents' concerns because of the company co-founder's wealth and influence. Follow the money, said Richard Davis, a Cherokee County landowner who testified in permit hearings on Tuesday. Davis opposes the project and has four parcels of land that are subject to the company's eminent domain requests. He testified that he sought help from state legislators to protect his land, but that they said Bruce Rastetter, the co-founder, has donated a lot of money to Reynolds' campaign, and that she, quote, will not act on this until the pipeline is through. Summit's $5.5 billion pipeline would transport captured carbon dioxide from ethanol plants in five states to North Dakota for underground sequestration. More than 680 miles of that pipeline system is planned for Iowa. Rastetter is an agriculture mogul and a major political donor. From 2015 to 2022, he donated more than $160,000 to Kim Reynolds for Iowa Campaign Committee, according to state campaign disclosure reports. Those donations preceded her ascent to governor in 2017, when former Governor Terry Branstad resigned to be the U.S. ambassador to China. The allegation of Rastetter's influence over elected officials is not new. In the past 2 years, as legislators struggled and ultimately failed to pass new legislation to restrict eminent domain for carbon dioxide pipelines, some of the legislators publicly said the same. How much money did Bruce Rastetter give you? Representative Jeff Shipley, a Republican from Birmingham, told people to ask their legislators in March 2022. There are a lot of people that bend over for money. They bend over so much sometimes, I'm surprised they can still walk, he said. But the allegation gained more traction this summer when the Iowa Utilities Board decided to start Summit's evidentiary hearing 2 months earlier than it had previously considered. The move prompted complaints from pipeline opponents and state lawmakers that the permit process was being accelerated toward approval. Summit has sought a decision on its permit in Iowa by the end of the year, and the company intends to start construction in 2024. That IUB decision followed Reynolds' appointment of a new member to the board, Eric Helland, who was a replacement for a member whose term was expiring. Reynolds further named him chairperson. Former chairperson Jerry Huser submitted her letter of resignation from the board less than a week later. Huser's term as chairperson was set to expire, but it could have been renewed, and she could have remained as a board member until at least 2027. Jerry Huser's announced resignation at the expiration of her term as chair of IUB after 8 years of service, and Governor Reynolds greatly appreciated her leadership, said Colin Crompton, the deputy communications director for Reynolds. Across state government, the governor has a long-standing policy of rotating board leadership and refreshing board membership to allow for new voices to be heard. However, the decision resulted in two new members on the three-person board, and that happened toward the end of Summit's permit process, which began in August 2021. The remaining incumbent board member, Josh Burns, had initially resisted a Summit hearing start date in October, primarily because it would conflict with harvest season and might prevent farmers affected by the project from participating. But Burns also questioned whether it was possible to effectively evaluate Summit's proposal in a shortened time frame, because it is the most, quote, resource-intensive project that has come before the board in 50 years, possibly since the board's inception, he wrote in February. He noted that board staff had initially proposed a hearing start date in May 2024. Burns reversed course after the appointment of the two new board members and supported the August 22nd start date. In July, he wrote that the board's decision to have some of the landowners who are subject to eminent domain requests testify at the start of the hearing, rather than at the end, alleviated his worries about harvest. He did not address his previous concerns about ensuring that the project is fully vetted. Rastetter also donated to lawmakers in the Iowa Senate who might have been key to blocking legislation this year that was overwhelmingly approved by the Iowa House and would have limited eminent domain for carbon dioxide pipelines. In 2019, 2020, and 2021, Rastetter gave a total of $37,500 to a campaign committee that supports Senator Jack Whitaker, a Republican from Grimes, the majority leader who decides what bills get a vote by the entire chamber. And last year, Rastetter gave $5,000 to the campaign of Senator Mike Bousselot, a Republican from Ankeny. He led a subcommittee to which the House bill was assigned, but the bill was never considered for recommendation. Bousselot was the subject of an ethics complaint over his handling of that bill, in part because he formerly worked for Summit Agriculture Group, which owns Summit Carbon Solutions. Bousselot and Whitaker did not immediately respond to requests to comment for this article. Donations don't necessarily equate to favorable votes. The Iowa Farm Bureau Federation, which supported the bill, also donated to the senators. The organization's donations in 2022 to them exceeded Rastetter's contributions that year. Also, Rastetter has contributed more than $35,000 to a campaign committee that supports Representative Matt Winchittle, the House Majority Leader who voted in favor of the bill. Rastetter also donated $26,000 last year to a campaign committee that supports Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd, who won her first term in the November election. Byrd's authority over the Office of Consumer Advocate was strengthened by a governmental reorganization bill that was one of Reynolds' legislative priorities. The office is charged with representing the interests of the public in utility proceedings, such as Summit's permit application. Anna, former attorney for the office, said she quit her job there in May because it had become, quote, more of an observer and less of an advocate. The concerns of undue influence are completely unfounded and untrue, Crompton, Reynolds' spokesman, told Iowa Capital Dispatch. The governor meets regularly with leaders from a wide variety of industries in Iowa, including agriculture, insurance, technology, and healthcare, to help inform policy priorities. Governor Reynolds' work with the legislature over the past 4 years to improve Iowa's economy and business climate has resulted in Iowa being recognized nationally as a top 10 state to live in, the number one state to retire in, the number one state for the lowest cost of living, the most fiscally responsible state in the country, the number two state for healthcare, top three for opportunity, the number four state for labor participation, and a top five state for first-time homebuyers. And continuing with state headlines is this one that reads, Iowa nurse loses license after drunk driving arrest. Allegations of missing narcotics. The Iowa Board of Nursing has revoked the license of a nurse who, while working at various Iowa care facilities, was accused of sleeping on the job, being responsible for missing narcotics, leaving work without authorization, failing to administer patient medications, and sitting in her car while on duty. According to board records, Alicia Davis was a licensed nurse working in Iowa last year as an independent contractor through the employment agency ShiftKey. In September 2022, Davis was covering a nursing shift at Greenfield Rehabilitation and Healthcare in Adair County when the facility filed a complaint about her with the board, regarding missing medications. Davis had allegedly explained the missing medications by stating she had accidentally doubled the dosage for two different patients, resulting in the shortage that was discovered during the next day's inventory of narcotics. A board investigator later examined records from Shift Key and found that over the course of 14 months, various employers had raised concerns regarding missing narcotics during Davis's shifts, as well as alleged failures to administer patient medication and document her work. According to the board, concerns were also raised about Davis allegedly being in her car during her shift, sleeping while on duty, and exhibiting odd behavior. According to the board, a check of court records indicated Davis had been arrested months before the incident in Greenfield on June 22, 2022, and charged with drunken driving and possession of a controlled substance. Police records indicated she was pulled over on U.S. 30 in Harrison County, after which an officer found a marijuana joint in the center console ashtray, along with THC, vape pens, drug paraphernalia, and edible marijuana. In January of this year, the Board of Nursing charged Davis with committing an act that might adversely affect a patient and the unauthorized possession or use of a controlled substance. On April 4th, with criminal charges still pending, the board held a hearing on the licensing charges. Davis did not appear for the hearing, noting that there were no court records and evidence documenting the criminal charge or any disposition. The board said it could not find by a preponderance of evidence that Davis had violated state regulations prohibiting possession or a controlled substance. However, the board found Davis was guilty of unethical conduct with regard to the incident at the Greenfield Care Facility and revoked her license. 3 weeks later, Davis entered a plea of guilty to the drunken driving charge. Prosecutors dropped the possession charge, and Davis was sentenced to probation. She was later charged with violating the terms of her probation by failing to meet with her probation officer. In June, after she failed to appear for a probation revocation hearing in court, a warrant was issued for her arrest. The probation violation charge is still pending. And you are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, September 5th, on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we remember Florence Dewey. Florence C. Dewey, age 94, of Clear Lake, passed away peacefully Thursday, August 24th, at Good Shepherd Healthcare Center in Mason City. A mass of a Christian burial for Florence will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 8th at Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church, located at 722 North Adams Avenue in Mason City. She will be laid to rest at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 7th at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, located at 310 First Avenue North in Clear Lake. The Lumley Family. A graveside service will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, September 11th at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in Mason City to honor the lives and lay to rest Mrs. Rosie J. Lumley, who was born September 10th, 1937, and passed away July 20th, 2023, and her children, Timothy S. Lumley, born February 6, 1961, and passed away January 20, 2023. Kenneth Lumley, born August 3, 1962, and passed away July 6, 2020. Gerald Kiroff, born March 6, 1956, and passed away on June 18, 2020. And his wife, Teresa Kiroff, born June 26, 1961, and died August 3, 2018. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel is in charge of arrangements. Next, we remember Alana Paulson. Alana K. Paulson, age 70, went to be with her Lord on August 12th in the arms of her husband at their home. Alana died of cancer. Memorial services will be held Saturday, September 9th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Praise Community Church, located at 11 2nd Street Northwest in Mason City. Alana was born on December 23, 1952 in Mason City. She was the daughter of Deloy and Gloria Reams Carroll. She married Mark Paulson on September 18, 1998 in Dallas. They had celebrated 24 years together before her passing. She worked for Geico Insurance for 24 years. Together, Mark and Alana started Broken Curses Ministry to teach and share wisdom with, quote, the broken. This ministry started at Cross Timbers Community Church in Argyle, Texas, where Mark and Alana were baptized into their faith with Jesus Christ. The two of them moved to Forsyth, Missouri area to enjoy retirement years. Alana was a lady who needed to be active, so she started a part-time job working at the Country Mart supermarket, where she made many good friends in the community. Alana enjoyed cooking, sharing food with others, sewing, making baby blankets for newborns, and meeting the needs of others. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband John Axelson, son Jared Axelson, and daughter Chastity Wood. Alana is survived by her loving husband Mark, also known as Cowboy Paulson, and her granddaughter Alana Faith Wood. Her two sisters, Deanne Frisbee from Rochester, Minnesota, and Polly Ann Harrison from Florida. Her brothers-in-law are Greg, Joe, Jeff, Larry, and Matt Paulson. Her sister-in-laws are Kathy Ferrier, Christy Tass, and Lisa Lane. She will be missed by a multitude of family and friends. Next, we remember Matthew Bird. Matthew Bird, age 44, of Clear Lake, passed away Thursday, August 24th at his home in Clear Lake of natural causes. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, September 8th at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, located at 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Burial will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Matthew's family will greet friends from 10 a.m. until the time of his service at the funeral home on Friday. Matt was born April 16, 1979, in Mason City and was a lifelong resident of Clear Lake. He was the youngest of three sons, born to Roy and Sherry Schlawing Bird. Matt attended school in Clear Lake and graduated from Mason City High School with the class of 1999. He enjoyed spending time with his family and was always joking around with his mom and brothers. Matt enjoyed drives around Clear Lake while listening to his favorite radio stations, but was always happy to get back home. Matt liked all kinds of music and enjoyed collecting radios and other electronics. Matt always looked forward to Christmas and would celebrate Christmas on the 25th of each month. He is survived by his mother, Sherry Bird, brothers Steve Bird and Dave Bird, as well as his niece and nephews, Ashley and Andrew Uveling, and Colin, Corey, and Alex Bird. Matt is preceded in death by his father, Roy Bird. Next, we remember Jimmy Gotch. Jim L., or Jimmy, as he was known, Gotch, age 66, of Lakewood, Colorado, passed away unexpectedly at Denver General Hospital from surgical complications on August 4th. Jimmy was born March 23, 1957, to parents Harold, or Gene as he was known, and Louise Bod Gotch in Mason City. Jimmy graduated from Clear Lake High School in 1976. Jimmy was a free spirit, moving from place to place, working in the construction and landscaping industry. He was briefly married to Leslie Ick and resided for the past 25 years in Denver, Colorado area. He was known by his friends as a computer whiz, consummate landscaping pro, and, quote, the king of amazing stories. Jimmy was truly an altruistic person. It was said that he would give the shirt off his back to someone in need, even if he didn't have another. He deeply cared for those in need, particularly the plight of the homeless, which he experienced in life. Jimmy is survived by brothers Michael Buns of Ames, Craig Gotch of Cedar Falls, Kurt Gotch of Fort Collins, Colorado, and sisters Patricia Hardy of Montrose, Colorado, and Lori Scalise of Anchorage, Alaska, along with many friends and relatives. Jimmy was preceded in death by his parents and brothers Rick Stoltzfus, Stephen Gotch, and Jeffrey Gotch. Several celebrations of life events have been planned. The first event was held at Walker Branch Park on Labor Day, September 4th, a barbecue to feed the homeless. The second event will be held at King's Rest, where Jim resided, tentatively set for September 24th. A special thank you to friends Sarah Schroeder and Brian Derry for all their help. And turning to Dear Abby, Abby responds to two letters today. The first one has a headline that reads, "Relationship with husband's daughter eroded over time." They write, "Dear Abby, I've been married to Frank for 2.5 years. We met and married quickly. Best decision ever. We each had raised 2 daughters as single parents with different parenting styles. Our girls now range in age from 30 to 33. They are adults with lives and children of their own. My daughters have accepted and come to love Frank. They have always been respectful and inclusive. In the beginning, his daughters treated me okay, but after 6 months, the older one decided I could not be around her children because I, quote, don't like her. I always treated her respectfully and did many things for her and her kids, babysitting, buying them things they needed, twice offering a place to stay when she was going through a divorce. She was always the boss of her father, and he puts her first over all else. There were things they would do secretly and exclude me. Now he doesn't see them at all. They don't talk. They explode. I'm certain at some point I will be blamed for keeping him away. I no longer want anything to do with her, but I encourage Frank to see his grandchildren. I'm an emotional mess over this. What do I do?" And it's signed, "Blending Badly in Nevada." And Abby responds, "Dear Blending Badly, because your husband's family's dysfunction is affecting your emotional well-being, consult a licensed mental health professional to help rid yourself of this undeserved burden. Because someone chooses to blame you for something you haven't done doesn't mean you must accept it. If you still have a relationship with your husband's other daughter, concentrate on her and you will be happier." And Abby's second letter today has a headline that reads, "Friends' Hypochondria and Complaints Wear Thin." They write, "Dear Abby, I have a longtime friend who's the queen of hypochondriacs. She's always sick or complaining that something is wrong with her, but she does nothing to improve her health. She has gone to holistic doctors for years, to no avail. I suggested it's time for her to consult regular doctors, since holistic ones weren't helping, and because she doesn't follow their advice anyway. She has made appointments with regular doctors, but has too much anxiety to go. She has been excluded from activities with friends because she's always sick, but doesn't understand why she has only one friend. She also talks incessantly about her abusive, narcissistic mother, but doesn't realize she is a bit narcissistic herself. Should I tell her what I think about her or just keep it to myself?" And it's signed, "Peeved in Pennsylvania." And Abby responds, "Dear Peeved, If she is hesitant to see a doctor who might actually get to the cause of her problems, it's probably because she's afraid of what she might hear. Of course, people who procrastinate for years are more likely to get bad news than those who are determined to nip any problem in the bud. If you can suppress your annoyance instead of calling her something unpleasant, it would be more helpful to point out what that hiding one's head in the sand is not an answer, and volunteer to go with her to her appointment. That's what a true friend does. And now turning to some state sports headlines. This one reads, college football, 5 takeaways from Northern Iowa's loss to Iowa State. The Dateline is Ames. The Iowa State Cyclones sent Northern Iowa home with a 30-9 win on Saturday. In a game like that felt like you and I could nab its first win over the Cyclones since 2016, Iowa State reaffirmed itself under Matt Campbell after a down 4-8 season in 2022. Here are 5 takeaways from UNI's 21-point loss to Iowa State. Number 1, same old, same old. Iowa State's runaway win, in spite of its off-season noise and uncertainty, seemed all too familiar for Panther fans. A strong defensive showing for the majority of the first half by Northern Iowa proved unsustainable, as the offense remained ineffective, gaining just 85 yards and 5 first downs with 2 turnovers in the first half. UNI head coach Mark Farley expressed disappointment in his team, refusing to single out and point a finger at any one position group or unit. "I think everybody has to take a share in the defeat," Farley said, "a share in the production, or the lack of, and move forward and get ready for next week. That will be the difference of how much you improve based on what they gain from watching this," he said. The Panthers' offense hits its stride too little too late, scoring on its first drive of the third quarter, with a touchdown coming later in the fourth. It was too little too late. Wide receiver Sam Schnee described the inconsistent play of the offense frustrating, particularly so because of its high expectations entering the season. "We couldn't get any plays started," Schnee said. "Finally, in the second half, we got our offense rolling a bit. We just have to come out better. We have high expectations for our offense, so coming out slow like that is just not a good feeling. The momentum was not there." Number 2, no time to panic. The loss to Iowa State likely feels worse than it should, following the uncertainty surrounding Iowa State throughout the month of August. Iowa State opened as a 10-point favorite on actionnetwork.com, and despite public money shifting the line slightly UNI's way, the Cyclones still kicked off as 7.5-point favorites. Although Iowa State felt vulnerable, a UNI victory served as the unlikelier of the two outcomes. ESPN gave the Cyclones a 91.1% chance of victory at kickoff, a probability that never dipped below 89.5%. Additionally, the Cyclones featured 14 returning letter winners on its defensive 2-deep from a defense that led the Big 12 in total defense in 2022. Given the unlikeliness of a UNI victory, combined with the strength of the Iowa State defense, the margin of defeat and ineffectiveness of the offense should not be cause for concern in Cedar Falls. Number 3, uncharacteristic performance by Day. Much of the hype surrounding and leading up to the 2023 season could be credited to the return of senior quarterback Theo Day. A preseason All-American via multiple outlets, many expected Day to pick up where he left off at the end of the last season and he very well may still do so. He, however, suffered a rough outing against the Cyclones to open the season on the wrong foot, throwing a pair of first-half interceptions. Day, at times, looked uncomfortable behind his new offensive line and seemed to play tight. Farley did not mince words when discussing Day's performance. "He missed a ton of throws," Farley said. "I would not say he missed a few. He missed a ton." How he responds will be more telling, according to Farley. When you set yourself up and you are viewed in the way that he was viewed all summer long, you are going to be challenged, Farley said. When you do not come through the challenge, there is a setback. That is where you have to self-eval. You better be strong enough. The good ones can overcome adversity and overcome days like this. Schnee said he expects Day to bounce back from his unusually poor play in Saturday's game. "I'm sure he is not happy," Schnee said, "but I know he will figure it out. He will make the adjustments this week in practice and be back for sure." Number 4, offensive line searching for consistency. The Iowa State defense racked up 4 sacks and 5 quarterback hurries in addition to 8 tackles for loss. The Cyclones' ability to get in the backfield reflected a strong presence up front, but also served as reflection of the inexperienced offensive line for the Panthers. The 4 new starters in the trenches, growing pains were going to be expected for the Panthers. The Panthers' new look line of Jared Penning, Josh Volk, Chase Ahrens, Carson Petlin, and Blake Anderson managed to keep Day clean, solid. managed to keep Day clean for solid stretches, but regressed at inopportune times. In particular, on the Panthers' first possession of the second half, UNI's line kept Day upright and clean for 4 dropbacks. However, on 2nd and 10 from the Iowa State 14-yard line, Jerry Vaughn flew into the UNI backfield untouched as Petlin failed to get hands on the blitzing backer. The play resulted in an underthrown ball intended for Brady McCullough, who managed to get a step on his defender with room to the back line of the end zone. Farley said he could not provide a full analysis of the offensive line without first watching the film, but did provide a first blush reaction to its performance. "We did not protect the edge," Farley said. "They do some things, this defense, create some angles. We did not protect well enough. I'm just looking at it as a whole, going, I am not pleased with our football team and the speed of play or the energy or the passion that we needed to play this game with to win a game like this or any other game for that matter." Number 5, found something in the second half. UNI outscored the Cyclones 9-7 in the second half and outgained Iowa State 194-101 while running 24 more plays. The second half surge showed more of what UNI's preseason expectations led one to believe going into the season. Farley said he felt the Panthers' play following halftime represented what he expected out of his team from the opening kickoff. "There should have been a lot more energy," Farley said. "Maybe it was because of the heat. The heat does play a factor. It takes a lot of zap out of you. You have to play with more energy, more intensity. That was what was lacking. Thus, the speed of play was not what it should have been to win a game like that. I'm not going to paint a white picket fence. I'm just going to tell them the truth of what I saw. There was just not much of really anything that happened besides the turnovers and punt returns on the field that day. There should have been more that happened. We have work to do. We have a lot of things to clean. It will probably start with personnel," he said. And that concludes today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, September 5th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and make it a great Tuesday.
in the People's Pharmacy Health headlines. At high doses, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active-duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction, and those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.